Nikki Strong, and this is VOA One of the Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak. This program is designed for English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
On today's program, John Russell tells us about a special restaurant in Pakistan. Dan Novak presents this week's education report. We close the show with the next part of our U.S. history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Baking Versa, an eatery in Lahore, Pakistan, is sometimes described as the country's costliest place for what it serves, flatbreads and meats. The eatery is a small space without windows. Dinners come on plastic plates, and diners sit on plastic stools. But Baking Versa gets visitors from across Pakistan and beyond. Visitors want to learn about the limited offerings, the owner, and the dining experience that sets it apart from other restaurants in the area. The eatery opens out onto Railway Road in Gavalmandi, an area filled with people, vehicles, animals, and food shops. Many of Gavalmandi's original communities came from Kashmir and the eastern Punjab area before 1947. That was the year India and Pakistan became independent from the former British Empire. The mix of Hindus, Sikhs, and Muslims gave diversity to Gavalmandi's businesses, culture, and food. Some in Lahore used to see Gavalmandi as virtually a no-go area, said Kamran Lashari, the director general of the Lahore Walled City Authority. But a makeover more than 20 years ago helped bring in more visitors. We had street performers. President Pervez Musharraf sat in the street with people all around him. The Prince of Jordan also visited. Indian newspapers reported on Gavalmandi, Lashari said. Eateries in Gavalmandi are generally not costly. But then there is Baking Versa, where dinner for two can quickly come to $60 without drinks because drinks, even water, are not served. By comparison, a basket of naan at the five-star Serena Hotel in the capital, Islamabad, sells for $1, and a serving of kebabs is $8. In Gavalmandi, one naan usually costs as little as 10 cents. Baking Versa makes five items: chicken, chops, two kinds of naan, and kebabs. Owner Bilal Sufi also sells bakarkhani, a pastry best enjoyed with a cup of pink Kashmiri chai. But diners must order everything days before arrival. The 34-year-old Sufi tells people that his eatery has been in the same place for 75 years, and he has been serving the same items for many years. Sufi has run Baking Versa for more than 3 years, taking over from his father, Sufi Masood Said, who ran it before him, and his grandfather, Sufi Ahmed Said, before that. He says he is only doing what his father and grandfather have done. He describes his ingredients, cooking methods, and where and how his meat is raised. His sheep are fed special food such as saffron milk, dates, and green bananas. He also tells people how to eat their food. Pick it up with your hands. Take a big bite. Eat like a beast, he tells them. A beast is a wild animal that is large or dangerous. There is no salad, no yogurt, and no chutney, he tells a possible diner on the phone. And if you ask for these, you won't get them, he said. The meal arrives in a special order. First, Sufi presents a whole chicken, for $30, followed by mutton chops at $12.50, then a kebab, which costs $8. Sufi says one kebab is enough for two people. Sufi insists on his diners knowing what they eat, where it comes from, how it is made, and why it tastes so different. And he has no plan to change anything. Baking Versa is a legacy, he says. I'm doing this out of love for my father. I'm John Russell.
Many schools in the United States are facing increased student behavioral and mental health needs. But parents and school officials are struggling to find out if some students' problems are tied to the COVID-19 pandemic or are long-term problems. Heidi Whitney is from San Diego, California. She has a daughter in middle school. The pandemic sent Whitney's daughter into crisis. She was sleeping all day and awake all night. When in-person classes started, she was so tense at times that she asked to come home early. Whitney tried to keep her daughter in class, but the girl's condition worsened. She had to go to the hospital and was diagnosed with depression and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD, a mental disorder. As she started high school this fall, Whitney's daughter was considered eligible for special education services because her disorders hurt her ability to learn. But school officials said it was hard to know how much of her behavior was a long-term condition or the result of mental health problems caused by the pandemic. They put my kid in a gray area, Whitney said.
Officials in many schools who are dealing with increasing student mental health needs have been struggling with difficult decisions. They are trying to find out whether the problems they are seeing are temporary or are the sign of more serious disabilities. Some observers say this puts pressure on parents trying to decide how best to help their children. The question is, if a child is not eligible for special education, where should parents go for help? Rules require school officials to say how they will meet the needs of students with disabilities in individualized education programs, IEPs. Some schools have struggled to catch up with mental health evaluations that were delayed in the early days of the pandemic. There is also a reported shortage of school psychologists. Federal law says to be eligible for special education services, a child's school performance must be suffering from one of 13 disability groups. They include autism, ADHD, learning disabilities like dyslexia, developmental delays, and emotional problems. John Eisenberg is the director of the National Association of State Directors of Special Education. He said it is important not to send children who might have had a difficult time during the pandemic into the special education system. That's not what it was designed for, he said. It's really designed for kids who need specially designed instruction. He added, special education is not for kids that might have not got the greatest instruction during the pandemic or have other issues. The National Center for Education Statistics found about 15% of all public school students received special education services in the 2020 to 2021 school year. Among children ages 6 and older, special education enrollment rose by 2.4% compared with the previous school year. The government numbers also showed a large drop in enrollment for younger preschool age students, many of whom were slow to return to school. Some special education directors worry the system is taking on too many students. But others say the opposite is the case. They say schools are moving too quickly to dismiss parents' concerns. Some children are having evaluations pushed off because of worker shortages, said Marcy Lipset. She is an activist for special education in Michigan. She said, in one school district, evaluations came to a complete halt in May because there was no school psychologist to do them.
It can be difficult to know the differences between problems that started because of the pandemic and an actual disability, said Brandy Tanner. She is an Atlanta-based psychologist who has had many requests from parents seeking evaluations for possible learning disabilities, ADHD, and autism. I'm asking a lot more background questions about pre-COVID versus post-COVID. Like, is this a change in functioning, or was it something that was present before and gotten worse, she said. Kevin Rubenstein is with the Council of Administrators of Special Education based in Missouri. He said it is important to have good systems in place to know the difference. The federal government, he noted, has provided large amounts of COVID aid money to schools. Some of the money is for counseling and other support to help students recover from the pandemic restrictions. But activists worry about what will happen to students who do not receive the help they might need. Children who do not get help might have more behavioral problems and fewer possibilities for life after school, said Dan Stewart. He is with the National Disability Rights Network. Whitney, the mother from San Diego, said she is happy her daughter is getting help, including a case manager. She also will be able to leave class as needed if she feels nervous. I realize that a lot of kids were going through this, she said. We just went through COVID. Give them a break. I'm Dan Novak.
And I'm Faith Perlow.
You just heard Dan Novak and Faith Perlow present this week's Education Report. Dan is here to talk more about his story. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks, Ashley.
I wanted to ask you about a word that often comes up in education stories, eligible. Could you explain to our listeners what that word means?
Sure. If you are eligible for something, it means you are able to be chosen or able to do or receive something. Some students are eligible for free lunch. Others are eligible to take advanced classes. This week's story centers on students that may or may not be eligible for special education.
So, what exactly makes a student eligible for special education?
Special education is for students that have certain learning disabilities like ADHD, autism, or dyslexia. But the question of who's eligible for special education has gotten much more complicated because of COVID. In the story, Heidi Whitney's daughter returned to in-person classes, and she had severe anxiety and was diagnosed with ADHD. But it was unclear to school officials whether her problems were short-term or something long-term that would require her to take special education classes. And there are many students around the country like Heidi's daughter. School officials, psychologists, and mental health experts are going to have to look at each individual student and decide what is best for them.
I see. That's very interesting, Dan. Thanks for answering my questions today.
You're welcome.
VOA Learning English has launched a new program for children. It is called Let's Learn English with Anna. The new course aims to teach children American English through asking and answering questions and experiencing fun situations. For more information, visit our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The battle between the North and the South spread in the summer of 1861. Union soldiers fought pro-Southern rioters in the streets of Baltimore and St. Louis. A Confederate supporter shot and killed a young officer from the North. Untrained soldiers from both sides fought in the mountains of western Virginia. So far, though, the fighting had not claimed many lives, but very soon the battle would become fierce. Frank Oliver and Jack Weitzel continue the story of the American Civil War.
The old general who commanded the Union forces, Winfield Scott, did not want to rush his men into battle. Scott believed it would be a long war. He planned to spend the first year of it getting ready to fight. He had an army of thousands of men, and it would get much larger in coming months. But this army was not trained. His soldiers were civilians who knew nothing about fighting a war. General Scott needed time to make soldiers of these men. He also needed time to organize a supply system to get to his forces the guns, bullets, food, and clothing they would need. Without supplies, his army could not fight very long.
There were many in the North, however, who thought Scott was too careful. It was true, they said, that Union forces were untrained, but so were those of the South, and the Confederacy's supply problems were even greater than those of the Union. The South had much less industry and fewer railroads. It could not produce as much military equipment, and it could not transport supplies as easily as the North could. In the early months of the war, Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, did not even have guns enough for the men in his army. Those who demanded immediate action expected a short war. They said Scott should take the army and march to Richmond. They were sure that if Union forces seized the Confederate capital, the Southern Rebellion would end. Northern newspapers took up the cry, "On to Richmond." Political leaders began pressing for a quick Northern victory. Public pressure forced the army to act. For more than a month, General Irvin McDowell had been building a Union army in Northern Virginia, just across the Potomac River from Washington. He had more than 30,000 men at bases in Arlington and Alexandria. Late in June, McDowell received orders. March against the Confederate Army of General Pierre Beauregard. Beauregard had 20,000 soldiers at Manassas Junction, a railroad village in Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. McDowell planned to move on Manassas Junction July 9th, but was delayed for more than a week. He planned the attack carefully. McDowell was worried that another large Confederate force west of Manassas Junction might join Beauregard's army. This force, led by General Joe Johnston, was in the Shenandoah Valley near Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Across from Harper's Ferry in Maryland was a Union army almost twice the size of Johnston's. It was ordered to put pressure on Johnston's force to prevent it from helping Beauregard. General Beauregard received early warning from Confederate spies that McDowell would attack. Much of his information came from a woman, Mrs. Rose O'Neill Greenhow. Mrs. Greenhow, a widow, was an important woman in Washington. She knew almost all the top government officials, and she had friends in almost every department of the government. The beautiful Mrs. Greenhow also had some very special friends. One was Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts. He was chairman of the Senate Committee on Military Affairs. Another special friend was Thomas Jordan, a Confederate colonel in Beauregard's army.
Jordan asked Mrs. Greenhow soon after the war started to be a spy for the South. She agreed and sent much valuable information about Union military plans. Early in July, she sent word to Beauregard that he would be attacked soon. She also sent a map used by the Senate Military Affairs Committee showing how the Union Army would reach Manassas Junction. Then, on the morning of July 16th, Mrs. Greenhow wrote a 9-word message. She gave it to a man to carry to Beauregard. The Confederate general received it that evening. It said, "Order given for McDowell to march upon Manassas tonight."
Beauregard sent a telegram to Richmond. He told the Confederate government that McDowell was on the way. He asked that Johnston's 10,000-man force in the Shenandoah Valley join him for battle. He was told to expect Johnston's help. But Johnston's army was threatened by a large Union force that entered Virginia from Maryland. Led by General Robert Patterson, the Union troops moved toward the smaller Confederate force. They were not really interested in fighting Johnston, but they did want to prevent him from reaching Beauregard. Johnston knew he could not defeat Patterson, so he decided to trick him. While most of his army withdrew and prepared to join Beauregard, Johnston sent a small force to attack Patterson's army. Patterson believed Johnston was attacking with all his troops. He stopped moving forward and prepared to defend against what seemed to be a strong Confederate attack. By the time the trick was discovered, Johnston and most of his troops were at Manassas.
General McDowell's huge Union army left Arlington on the afternoon of July 16th. It was a hot day, and the road was dusty. The march was not well organized, and the men traveled slowly. They stopped at every stream to drink and wash the dust from their faces. Some of the soldiers left the road to pick fruits and berries from bushes along the way. To some of those who watched this army pass, the lines of soldiers in bright clothes looked like a long circus parade. Most of these men had not been soldiers long. Their bodies were soft and they tired quickly. It took them 4 days to travel the 45 kilometers to Centerville, the final town before Bull Run. The battle would start the next morning, Sunday, July 21st.
The road from Washington was crowded early Sunday morning with horses and wagons bringing people to watch the great battle. Hundreds of men and women watched the fight from a hill near Centerville. Below them was Bull Run. But the battleground was covered so thickly with trees that the crowds saw little of the fighting. They could, however, see the smoke of battle, and they could hear the sounds of shots and exploding shells. From time to time, Union officers would ride up the hill to report what a great victory their troops were winning.
In the first few hours of the battle, Union forces were winning. McDowell had moved most of his men to the left side of Beauregard's army. They attacked with artillery and pushed the Confederate forces back. It seemed that the Confederate defense would break. Some of the Southern soldiers began to run. But others stood and fought. One Confederate officer, trying to prevent his troops from moving back, pointed to a group led by General T.J. Jackson of Virginia. "Look," he shouted, "there is Jackson standing like a stone wall. Fight like the Virginians." The Confederate troops refused to break. The fighting was fierce. The air was full of flying bullets. A newsman wrote that the whole valley was boiling with dust and smoke. A Confederate soldier told his friend, "Them Yankees are just marching up and being shot to hell." Neither side would give up. Then a large group of Johnston's troops arrived by train and joined in the fight. Suddenly, Union soldiers stopped fighting and began pulling back. General McDowell and his officers tried to stop the retreat, but failed. Their men wanted no more fighting.
The fleeing Union soldiers threw down their guns and equipment, thinking only of escape. Many did not stop until they reached Washington. It was a bitter defeat, but it made the North recognize the need for a real army, one trained and equipped for war. President Abraham Lincoln gave the job of building such an army to General George McClellan.
And that's our program for today. Join us again tomorrow to keep learning English through stories from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Dan Novak.